Welcome, teacher friend. I'm Lori.
And I'm Melissa.
We are two literacy educators in Baltimore. We want the best for all kids, and we know you do too.
Our district recently adopted a new literacy curriculum, which meant a lot of change for everyone. Lori and I can't wait to keep learning about literacy with you today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Melissa and Lori Love Literacy. We are thrilled that you're here with us today because we have a very special guest. I know I always say that, but really this is a returning guest who is...
Our first returning guest.
Yay! Natalie Wexler. Melissa, how excited are you to have her back again?
Always excited. Of course, you know that we are Natalie Wexler super fans. So super excited. But
the picture that we have of us wearing the Wild About Wexler shirts, I'm sure Natalie...
That's right.
Framed in her house. Natalie, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Lori and Melissa. It's great to be back.
Yeah. So for those listening who did not catch Natalie's first podcast, she's the author of The Knowledge Gap, co-author of The Writing Revolution. She writes for a variety of publications, including Forbes. And she's just so incredible that you should just run out after this podcast and read all of her articles. Grab the book, The Knowledge Gap, and sit down and read it tonight because it's raining. And what else are we going to do during quarantine anyway? So, Natalie, will you briefly share a little bit about, I think maybe The Knowledge Gap would be most applicable, just a quick little snapshot of what it is for those who are listening who may not know about your book.
Sure. I will give the briefest version I can. It's really the term knowledge gap is a play on, you know, the achievement gap. It's a gap in test scores, essentially, between haves and have-nots. And basically, my argument is we've been looking at this as a gap in skills, reading skills, and not just decoding skills, but comprehension skills. That's what these tests appear to measure. But in fact, if you don't have the background knowledge and the vocabulary to understand those reading passages on standardized reading tests, you don't get a chance to demonstrate your skill at finding the main idea or making an inference. But instruction, especially in elementary school, has kind of paralleled or mimicked what's on those tests. So instead of building the kind of knowledge and vocabulary that kids need to understand the passages, which could come from social studies and science and the arts, all sorts of things, teachers have been giving kids in many schools sort of disconnected passages and just having them practice these supposed skills like finding the main idea, etc., which really has resulted in us shooting ourselves in the foot. And the discrepancy in scores between haves and have-nots really has a lot to do with the knowledge that kids pick up outside school and kids with more educated parents are in a better position to just pick up the kind of knowledge and vocabulary that helps them do well, not only on reading comprehension tests, but also in high school and beyond.
Yeah.
Oh,
sorry, Melissa.
I was just going to say, I just had a conversation with our, here in Baltimore City, Office of Assessments and Accountability, and had this similar conversation, but you said it so much better in like 1 minute.
I'll have to a lot of practice.
Record that and let them listen to it.
Here's your elevator pitch.
Yes, exactly.
I was thinking, every time you talk about it, Natalie, it reminds me of when, like, I have a flashback to my second grade classroom a decade ago when I had a bulletin board and we would start our day by doing the calendar and the you know, all the stuff that you do with the little guys to start the day. But the bulletin board had our focus, skill or strategy for the week. And I will be 100% honest. I, you know, in hindsight, I was looking at it and I'm thinking, what's the difference between a skill or a strategy? They must be the same thing. I don't know, but this is what they're telling me. And we're going to learn how to find the main idea. And we had a main idea Sunday. And that's, you know, the graphic organizer that we used to find the main idea and some, you know, trite paragraph about whatever it was that we could find the main idea. So every time you say that, I just have this flashback to the bulletin board and I wish I had a picture of it so I could show you, but you know, it feels like guilty, but at the same time, like, now that we know better, we're building knowledge.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that from a lot of teachers that they feel guilty. And I think I can really understand that. But as you say, you know, I mean, better to change and do something that does work than to be trapped by your feelings of guilt into continuing to do the same thing that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, Natalie, that this is an interesting time of trying to do distance learning across the United States. So, you know, that this thing that you're talking about right now is potentially exacerbated by what kinds of things kids are getting at home, from packets to attempting to do some kind of virtual learning. So we'd love to just talk to you a little bit about that. I know you wrote an article that has some tips, so we would just love to talk about what you're seeing.
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, since the knowledge gap does have its roots in the different experiences that kids have at home outside of school, and now kids are home all the time, it is inevitably getting wider by the day. I mean, I would say, you know, one tip, sort of a basic tip, is especially if you're an elementary or middle school ELA teacher and you have a basal reader or something that's focusing on skills, try asking questions about the content and supplementing that content, if it's thin, with some other texts. I mean, that's not only going to help build kids' knowledge, but it's also, from what I've heard, certainly more engaging for kids. And I think some parents are seeing that, who are able to compare. As I know, Laura, you have been able to, a skills-focused approach to comprehension against a knowledge-building approach. And it's also just generally, I think, easier for parents to help their kids, any parent, with content-focused material. They can say, oh, gee, tell me, you read about whales? Tell me, what did you learn about whales? Rather than, so what was the author's purpose? And I mean, that just doesn't come naturally to a lot of adults, a lot, or not teachers.
I don't know if it comes naturally to teachers either.
it may not at the beginning. But beyond that, I think, you know, the things that make all teaching, any kind of teaching effective, are even more important when it comes to remote learning and remote teaching. And one of the most important, I think, is just checking for understanding. I think often teachers assume that their kids have gotten the basic idea, and they want to move on to, let's think critically about that, let's do some analysis. And they may not be aware that half the class or more has not understood the basics. I heard another podcast that had a college instructor talking about how she had used the polling feature in Zoom, I think it was, to do a comprehension check of something she thought would, like, the whole class was really just going to understand this. This was just a sort of warm-up question. And she found that half the class did not understand it. You know, in that way, perhaps remote learning provides an advantage. You can do that kind of instantaneous comprehension check, but you can do comprehension checks in face-to-face situation too. It's really important in the remote situation, because you can't necessarily detect confusion. You can't necessarily see it on kids' faces or whatever. So that's one thing.
Natalie, can I jump in there real quick with a question for you? So sure. The checking for understanding, connecting back to your other point about, like, skills. So I think when I was teaching, the big checking for understanding was around a standard, right? That you would take a standard and check for that understanding. And then this is what breaks my heart about my teaching, Lori, is, like, then you, like, check it off that they've mastered that standard. And I just want to clarify that, like, when you're talking about checking for understanding, what I'm assuming you're talking about is that they're understanding what they're reading, right? They're understanding what they're getting from the text.
The content, yes. Yeah. So not, do you understand what a main idea is and what a detail is? But, yes. I mean, you could say, so what, I mean, it's not like you can never ask what was the main idea of that paragraph. You have to make sure in advance that there was a main idea, you know. I wrote about this. There was this tweet from a New York City parent whose kindergartner had gotten this reading assignment to find the main idea of a paragraph that had no main idea. It was really just a list of ocean animals, you know. The author of the tweet said, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and I could not do my kindergartner's reading assignment.
Do you remember where that worksheet was from?
I think it was from this teacher. There was something in the bottom that said teachers pay teachers. So this, you know, and it's not the teacher's fault. I mean, this is what the teacher's training had led her to do. And I'm sure she was in a, you know, this is a difficult situation. So it's not any teacher's fault. It's a system.
Yeah. Yeah. And Melissa, that's a brilliant point to clarify. Like it is, we're not checking for understanding for standards 2, 3, and 7, right? Mm-hmm. We're checking that they understand the content of it. So that's really smart to clarify. Cool. Natalie, we'll give you the mic back. What are those other tips? Fabulous tips.
Let's see. I'm not sure I can remember all 7 of them, but you know, to make things as interactive as possible, get students engaged. One of the big obstacles is just getting students to show up, especially those who may not have reliable access to the internet, et cetera. And then there's a limit to what teachers can do about that. But, you can try to make your expectations as clear as possible about what kids are supposed to do and when they're expected to show up. Keep it simple, not too many different apps and platforms. But the interactivity thing is also really important in establishing that sense of connection and getting students to want to show up. And I think that, you know, it can be difficult to arrange for that synchronous learning. And there's some things that are better done, you know, synchronous, meaning everybody there at the same time, like on a Zoom call, like now. But there may be some advantages sometimes to doing things in an asynchronous manner where people are accessing this, kids are accessing the same content, but at different times. You don't have to deal with everybody's schedules. And so the balance is going to be different depending on the age and the content and stuff like that. But to have at least some element where the kids and the teacher are all interacting together, I think is really important if you can swing that. And then there's also just making things really clear. Remote learning generally has not been found to be that effective, except maybe for kids who are already strong students. It's never going to be a great substitute for face-to-face learning. There are a few kids and a few teachers who are saying they like it better for various reasons, but I think for the majority, it's more difficult. And one of those difficulties is just acquiring new information through remote learning. It's been found to work best for review. Mm-hmm. And you should not ignore or overlook the importance of review, but you are going to need to introduce new information given how long this is going on. And you need to be aware that a little bit will go a long way, that kids' engagement is going to drop off. And so you don't want to go on and on. You want to pause, ask them questions, even if it's a video, say, pause the recording and try to answer in your own, for yourself, this question, because that's what's going to help them really absorb and retain the information, if they're actively processing it in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read a stat that kids can't really take any more than 9 minutes at a time. Like their attention kind of drops off after 9 minutes. I just think about that, like that, what you said about the asynchronous versus synchronous, how that balance could really complement that they could be doing some asynchronous work on their own and then come, you know, to a 25, 30 minute Zoom meeting with a small group or with their class and get some time with their teacher, extending or supporting what they did in that asynchronous environment, shifting, you know, keeping the focus of that over into the synchronous. And then there's just a nice little balance of that. Yeah. So I think that's important. But the 9 minutes struck me. I was like, wow, it's not that long.
I know. And I think for adults, there's often a drop off, maybe not after 9 minutes. One other thing that I didn't mention that I'd like to is I talk sometimes about the way we can use writing to build knowledge. I think, you know, in some ways, the remote situation is fairly well suited for that. And you don't have to ask kids to write at length. In fact, if they're inexperienced writers, it's better if you just ask them to write at the sentence level. But that's a great check for understanding. It's a great way of getting kids to actually think about the content. Again, not the standard, but content. You mentioned the writing revolution. There are lots of sentence level activities that can be adapted to all kinds of content and all grade levels in that book. And I think, you know, you can do that through a Google Doc, or you can do it through email, you know. I suppose you could do it through snail mail, even.
That's funny. Natalie, Melissa, I don't think I told you this either. I know now I've talked about my dad a bit on this podcast, but he thought when we did, so Great Minds did Knowledge on the Go. And so I've talked about that before. We've had Rachel Stack on to talk about it. And so I shared the website link with him and I said, you know, I'm a seventh grade teacher. If you want to look, it's kind of cool. And so he is looking at it and he called me later that night and he goes, so are the kids going to submit their assignments to you? They're just going to, they have your address, right? To mail your mail their assignments. I'm like, what are you talking about? He thought I was going to be grading like the entire world's seventh grade assignments. And I just was like cracking up hysterical that A, he didn't think about like email or virtual submission, that he thought they were going to physically mail me what they were doing. And I just loved it because it was when you said seminar, I was like, oh, that's exactly like what he thought.
Well, I was thinking of the connectivity issues and things like that.
Yeah. I actually have an interesting question about the physical versus online. Because we just had Maryland Book Bank on recently about like getting books into kids' hands. And I know that Knowledge on the Go did a great job of like making sure kids could access the text, whether they had it or not, because I mean, we just dropped school and weren't there the next day. So there is no structure to get them. But I'm just wondering if there is any like thought behind, is anyone thinking about that? Like, does it matter if kids have the text, like the actual text in their hands, or if it's virtual, or I have no idea.
There's definitely been research on the differences between reading on a screen and reading hard copy. And essentially, I mean, you know, they're complexities in this research, but sure. I would say the bottom line is that you tend to retain information better when you've read it in a hard copy form rather than on a screen. And that's particularly true for nonfiction or, you know, informational text.
Which is interesting, don't you think? Because I feel like I get most of my informational reading from a screen. Like, you know, the New York Times comes to my email.
Yeah, I mean, we get 3 hard copy newspapers a day, but we are and I do spend a lot of time all day long reading, you know, articles and whatnot on a screen. I think there are ways to. I think there may be. I haven't done an experiment on myself. But there may be a difference in my retention depending on whether it's on a screen or hard copy form. But what I find myself doing, if I really want to retain the information I'm reading on a screen, I take notes on it. Yeah. And that, of course, is a great way for retaining information, is to take notes. And so I think that's my own kind of compensating mechanism for whatever is going on the screen.
Yeah, that's actually a great transition. You're using a strategy.
Yeah.
knowledge. you know, speaking of that, like thinking about knowledge focused or content focused instruction or learning versus strategy focused, how is like remote learning impacting all of this? Like, what is happening in remote learning in more cases than not? Or have you found anything that, you know, any thoughts on that?
You know, I don't really know what's going on out there. I wish we had more information. This issue of curriculum is not something that journalists are focusing on by and large. I mean, I certainly have heard anecdotally from people like you actually that it's working much places that have a content focused curriculum. The remote learning experience is can be smoother. There are the videos that, you know, Wit and Wisdom has put out, Knowledge on the Go. There's the greater ability of parents maybe to help their kids. But, you know, I think in a lot of places, teachers and students are just kind of struggling to hold their heads above water. And what I really worry about, we know that these gaps are growing. And what I really worry about is what's going to happen when kids do come back to classrooms. And there's a lot of discussion now about how are we going to assess the learning that's been lost and the gaps at that point. And I expect that in most classrooms, what's going to be done at these, you know, what we've been doing all along to monitor progress, give kids these tests to see what their reading level is, and then tell them to read books at that level. And don't worry, we're not going to worry about building knowledge because we need to work on those comprehension skills. And that's only, I'm afraid, going to make a pretty dire situation even worse.
Yeah, I agree. I worry about that too. I worry that it's going to be what Melissa described earlier as that check for understanding being standards based. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've heard, and Melissa, I know you're in this too, so add to it. Obviously Cressley is in a school system that, and I want to acknowledge again, they tried their best. Like they said that we were closing on, I think, a Thursday, and the next day was the last day of school. So it was like the 12th, and then the 13th was the last day. And then, you know, boom, we're gone for the rest of the school year. So, you know, I want to acknowledge they're doing their best, but their learning plan has changed a couple of times throughout. It's made it a little challenging to follow as a parent. And then they transitioned from work packets to a synchronous experience with face-to-face meets with the class and some small group work. And I believe that that's across the county. But I do notice, like, in the work that does come home via the packet or, what's happening, they are using a strategy focused curriculum a strategy focused approach, because I'm not certain it's from the curriculum or if they're creating it. I'm gonna share a couple of questions and from one of the worksheets, just because I thought it would be helpful to just like hear the difference for those of you listening. Hear the difference between, like, Natalie is talking about knowledge and content driven versus strategy focused. Like, what does that actually look like? So Presley is asked to read a passage about sports, and it's like three paragraphs. And it's a very isolated, out of context thing. We haven't been reading about sports. We haven't been learning about sports. And then to answer three questions, at the top of the page, it says comprehension, cause and effect. And then the three questions are, why are rules important in sports? What happens when a basketball player shoots the ball through the hoop? And what happens when a batter in baseball misses three balls or three pitches? And, you know, from a parent standpoint, I'm thinking, well, she doesn't even need to read that to answer that because she already knows the answer to all those questions, you know? and also, I don't understand how that's cause and effect so much as, I mean, maybe loosely cause and effect. But I'd love to, like, keep that in mind, that, like, those questions are obviously very, you don't need to read the passage. They're not rigorous. I don't personally think they're really meeting a standard. I don't know that the text is definitely not meeting any standard. But yet we're asking her to do this work. And so, you know, as an alternative, right, like this knowledge-based approach that really travels well, as we've seen, we know that has such an impact on comprehension. Natalie, what would you recommend, like, or what do you see as an alternative to that? Like, how could we best teach strategies in context and build knowledge? Because I think that is the approach that we're kind of talking about as being a more effective one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I it's not that what I am arguing is you can never ask a child, like, what is the main idea, or, you know, what is the cause and effect relationship between these events. It's a question of what's put in the foreground. And so, you know, part of my research for the book was following these two early elementary classrooms through a school year, one using a basal reader or skills focused approach to comprehension, and the other using core knowledge language arts, which is one of the newer content focused curricula. And so the teacher, one of the slides I showed in my presentation, so I'm very familiar with it, the teacher would ask questions that might sound like strategy questions, like, with their reading about the myth of Daedalus and Icarus, she might ask the kids, can you predict what Daedalus's plan is? Or they made a chart of cause and effect based in the myth of Daedalus and Icarus. This was what they were doing during and after the read aloud. But the teacher wasn't trying to teach the skill of determining cause and effect or the skill of making predictions. She was bringing those things in to help kids think about the myth of Daedalus and Icarus. And they were very engaged in that. And so I think that what we've done is we've put those strategies in the foreground on the assumption that they need to be taught separately in a separate reading class, as opposed to being embedded in content, in social studies content, in science content, any content. And actually, there's some research to indicate that kids are going to be better able to learn those kinds of strategies in the context of something that's familiar to them. In one instance, it was baseball, which tends to come up, right? We know about the baseball study. There's also, I'd like to add, you don't have to say to kids, okay, now we're going to learn how to make an inference. You know, you could just ask them a question that requires them to make an inference. And there was this very interesting study that was done about 10 years ago, comparing a classroom that used strategy-focused instruction against a classroom, I think, I don't remember the grade level, but I'm pretty sure it's elementary, that used content-focused instruction. And what they found, that this was a two-year study, was that for one thing, the kids in the content-focused classroom had much richer discussions. And the questions could be very vague, like, gee, what's going on here? And that would lead to a much more engaged discussion than, so what do you, what inferences can you make about it? But also they found that the kids in the content-focused classroom, their comprehension was better than the kids in the strategy-focused classroom. And one of the authors of that study speculated that when you put the strategy in the foreground, you're asking kids to go through a kind of routine, and that takes up space in their, brains, in their working memory, that they cannot devote to actually understanding the content. So it's kind of this hoop you make them jump through that is not necessary.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, those questions that Lori asked, in the way that they're framed, right, is like this cause and effect. That was what they were, they're designed to see if students know cause and effect. and that goes back to my earlier point of I think what we would do here is then say, yes, Presley can do cause and effect, check it off. But that's not the case, because she might get another text where she doesn't know anything about the topic, and then therefore she might not know the cause and effect relationship that's happening in that text.
Right.
But I do see those questions could potentially be if you have a student and you want to just check that they're understanding what's going on, and if this was a valuable text to be reading, what does happen when the batter hits the baseball might be something good for a teacher to ask, just to get a sense of, are they understanding the text at a basic?
Yeah. I mean, but I would say why read about sports in the first place? I mean, you should start.
Yes.
I think we really put the cart before the horse. Is this something we want kids to learn about?
Yeah.
Maybe, but we should be making that decision independently of what skills we want them to acquire.
Yeah.
Melissa and I,
as we shared before we podcasted, Melissa and I had probably spent 6 hours discussing all of this. And Melissa, I feel like we've talked a lot about the benefit of a high quality curriculum, really echoes what you just said, Natalie, that the learning is not just, okay, Presley's learning about sports and that's it, this topic in second grade, end of year, but that when you have a high quality curriculum, it's not just in your classroom. It's not just this experience that's happening in your classroom as the teacher. That's this isolated event. It's this really beautiful horizontal design of knowledge build with strategies embedded, right? I mean, think about Wit and Wisdom. We have our content stages. It's exactly what you said, Natalie. We're asking kids, what is happening in this text? What does this reveal about blank? What's the big picture idea? All of those are really relevant to reading texts. But it also is this beautiful build of vertical knowledge. So it's not just about the student's experience in, you know, Melissa Loftus's class in seventh grade at whatever school. It's about the student's experience from the time that they enter kindergarten all the way through their knowledge build of eighth grade, and then taking it even further in high school and just preparing them for that college and career experience. And so that's what I think when I talk to teachers and, you know, try to explain like what is knowledge building and why is it important and, you know, what does it even mean? I try to go from the student experience because I think it takes like that teacher feeling of, you know, I don't know, like my creativity is being taken away or whatever it might be. But like that piece where we're saying, it's not about like teachers, right? It's about students, and think about your students' experience, not just in your fourth grade classroom, but throughout their whole fourth grade year and then throughout their entire educational career. So that's just what it made me think of. Like, it's not, you know, it's more about the student experience and the knowledge build over time. And that's what really makes the texts and the topics and the tasks that they explore really beautiful, because they build.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw that in the second grade class I was following. They would go, oh, I remember that from first grade. I mean, I remember once, I think it was during the War of 1812. Believe it or not, these second graders completely understood the issues in the War of 1812 because they had already learned about the colonial era and, you know, and the revolution. And you ask the average American adult to explain the War of 1812, you will get a blank look. But one of the kids in the class, a little girl, raised her hand, and we're talking about a surrender, and she said, and you know, when somebody surrenders, they raise a white flag. And the teacher said, yeah, how did you know that? And the little girl said, well, I remember from last year, the American Revolution. And all the other kids said, yeah, yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. And kids get very excited when they can make those connections.
Yeah. My mom's here visiting. I know that's not what you're supposed to do during quarantine, but you know, I need help with Elliot. So she's here. but she is a teaching assistant. And so I was just listening to her do a reading lesson online with a couple students. And they were reading about the Statue of Liberty. And the questions were so interesting. Like, she was asking things like, well, what war did this happen? And these were all like part of, I'm so sure, a worksheet similar to what you shared, Lori. Which country did the Statue of Liberty come from as a gift to the United States, and all these things. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, if this was part of a bigger unit that where they learned about, I forget which war it was, World War I, I believe, World War I, you know, that they might be able to make those connections, but they weren't. They were just trying to like recall from the passage that they had just read. So
yeah. And this, you know, this happens all the time. I was talking to a teacher in Tennessee yesterday, the day before, who's been using Core Knowledge Language Arts, and she was skeptical of it at the beginning. And she's, a lot of what she said has echoed a lot of what you guys have said, but she was talking about writing and how no teacher in her school liked teaching writing before. It was such a struggle to get the kids to write. Mm-hmm. But now with Core Knowledge, they're so eager to write. They have all of this information actually that they can write about it. Duh. I mean, you can't write about stuff you don't know. And she said, but I don't understand. You know, I have to prepare them for the state test. And on the state test, they get a paragraph or two, and then they have to, you know, write about it. They have to write an opinion essay or whatever. Yeah. And when I try to get them to do that, they just complain and they don't want to write. And I say, you know, this is just the same thing you were doing with the Greek myths or whatever. But the difference is they don't know enough about whatever is in that two paragraphs to write much about it.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah, I'm excited that some states, I think Louisiana is leading the charge. They're turning toward a knowledge-based assessment that echoes what the students learned throughout the year, which is amazing. You're really going to see what they know and what they don't know.
To me, what's kind of amazing is that this is such a revolutionary idea that what we've been doing essentially is testing kids on sort of what knowledge they might have happened to pick up, instead of testing them on the knowledge we're actually trying to teach them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Louisiana is doing, I, it's a fairly small pilot at the moment, but I really hope that it will expand and that other states will follow that lead, because it does make sense. And it's not just their ELA curriculum that they're basing the reading test in, but also their social studies curriculum. And that's really important. Mm,
yeah. That's amazing. I'm so excited. I can't wait to see the results of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You too.
Every time we talk about state assessments and thinking about familiarity with what's on them, I remember taking an assessment when I was younger, I don't know, maybe like fourth grade, and the passage, so I lived in New Jersey, and the passage was around Lucy the Elephant. I don't know if you've ever heard of Lucy the Elephant.
I've been to Lucy the Elephant.
Is this the one in Atlantic City?
It's, yeah.
So my dad worked in Atlantic City growing up, so my whole life. So we frequently went to the beach, and I knew Lucy the Elephant, and I was like, oh, I remember seeing the passage like in my head to this day, you know, at almost 40, I'm like, I remember that Lucy the Elephant passage, because it struck me, because it was one of the only things I knew about, like reading about. And it just seems insane to test kids on things that they don't know.
Yeah,
like that for all of them.
So this teacher in Tennessee I was speaking with said that she recalled from one of the state tests, there was a passage that had to do with Native Americans. And afterwards, one of the students said to the teacher, was it Cherokee? You know, never encountered. And another principal of a school in New York City told a story about how one of his kids did a state reading test and afterwards said, you know, it was okay, but like, what is Rug by? And he said, what are you talking about? Can you write it down? And she wrote down R-U-G-B-Y, rugby. But of course, she'd never heard of rugby. She was in the Bronx, you know?
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Well, that's crazy.
We look forward to hearing about those results. Well, we'll have to have you on to do like a reveal. A reveal party.
Sure.
For Indiana's results. So are there any other studies that you feel like, or, you know, research studies or researchers or podcasts or anything that you would recommend that listeners who are sitting there thinking, okay, I want to know more about strategy-focused instruction versus a knowledge-based approach, and what can I do to learn more to get my hands on some stuff?
Well, I mean, as far as podcasts, there are things like the Science of Reading podcast, which could be helpful. But, you know, when it comes to this sort of comparison between a content-focused approach and a strategy-focused approach, you know, unfortunately, there's not a huge amount of research out there. And we do have a lot of research that shows that. And I think this may be confusing for a lot of teachers, because they've heard, well, there's evidence behind strategy instruction. And there are lots and lots of studies showing that if you teach kids strategies, it will boost their comprehension on standardized reading tests. So what's the problem? And one problem is that those studies lasted usually no more than 6 weeks, right? And so we do this month after month, year after year, and there's no benefit. Certainly no proven benefit beyond six weeks. But a cognitive scientist named Dan Willingham has looked at that data and said, actually, after just 2 weeks, you're really not getting much bang for the buck with the strategy instruction. So I think that's one thing that people need to realize about strategy focused instruction. And Dan Willingham has written an article called The Usefulness of Brief Instruction in Reading Strategies, I believe.
That's a good one.
Yes. But beyond that, so the National Reading Panel, you know, I think seemed to endorse teaching reading comprehension strategies. They found, they summarized the evidence from all of these studies. And it is out there, but what they omitted to mention was the important role, which is really widely agreed upon, the very important role of prior knowledge in comprehension. And, you know, so one of the strategies might be activating prior knowledge, but if kids don't have the prior knowledge to activate, then what do you do? And that's where building knowledge needs to come in. But, you know, one reason we don't have studies sort of comparing strategy instruction with a knowledge building approach is that these studies, as I mentioned, generally last like 6 weeks. And building knowledge, as Laurie was talking about, is a really gradual cumulative process. So, you know, to take a group of students and build their knowledge about a topic for 6 weeks and then give them a standardized reading comprehension test that may have nothing about that topic on it, you're unlikely to see much in the way of results. Although I've heard of stories where, you know, some things like that can happen, but it's really a gamble. So what you really need to show the effects of building knowledge is something that extends across grade levels over years. And that's really hard to do logistically, an experiment like that, because kids move in and out of schools, teachers move in and out of schools, teachers vary in their approach and what they're doing. And so you can't really control the variables very well in those kinds of long-term studies. And also we haven't had these kinds of knowledge building curricula. They haven't been around that long yet. So it's hard to study them over time. So I think for all of those reasons, we don't have the evidence that we'd really like to show that, you know, there's a direct causal relationship between building knowledge and boosting students' overall comprehension, sort of on a standardized test.
Yeah, I have a very concrete example of your strategy going overboard. So I think Laurie and I were part of a system where text annotation became a thing, like a really big thing. And we were doing, I mean, Natalie, when I say it was, I mean, K to 12, well, maybe not K, but K, K to 12.
Yes, K.
You know, we are annotating the text and we were annotating every text, whether it was something that was easy for you to understand or not, you're annotating the text. People started getting these symbols, right? So you put a little exclamation point or a question mark. And then kids are starting to ask, like, well, how many annotations do I need to do, right? They're not even reading the text. It's like, you want me to do annotations? Let me write my annotations. And it just became about the annotations and not about actually reading a text and getting any content or building any knowledge from that reading that text. So yeah. I can definitely see how we were part of it, where we just went overboard with what could be, like, annotating a text is I do it when I read sometimes.
It can be very helpful, but it's not the one thing that.
Right. And that not every student needs to do it every time for every text, right? It is a tool that you can put in your tool belt. Sharing that, like, that's an example of, like.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened with this strategies, comprehensive strategies is, there's evidence that this can have a positive effect. Let's do it all the time. So let's do the whole curriculum. There's no evidence pointing to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's really both and. Like, I think there's in education, we want to be like, well, what comes, you know, the cart before the horse, what's coming first, strategies or knowledge? And really, it's both at the same time, at least from my investigation of high quality curricula, that's what's happening is that, you know, and speaking to Wit and Wisdom, the content stages are embedded within the content. And like you said, we're not sitting down and saying, okay, friends, today I'm going to ask you lots of questions about inferences. You're just asking questions to support making inferences because it's important to do so with this text. And Melissa and I talked about the text really driving the instruction, and it's really that grounding factor that, you know, the text is driving all of those questions, and they're not contrived questions. Melissa, you want to say anything about that, or Natalie? Sorry, I didn't want to cut anybody off. It's raining so hard here. It's hard to hear you guys. I keep going on. It's like, and I don't want the listeners to be like, is she in the bathroom? Or
well, I'm not hearing that rain.
Oh, good. Okay.
But I do think that you said something about like that you need both and it's not like one should be in the foreground. But I have to say, I would argue that the content really should be in the foreground and that the skills and strategies or whatever you want to call them, they need to come in service of that content. And, you know, I mean, like I've heard David Lieben say that it's not like kids need to necessarily be taught how to make an inference. Toddlers make inferences all the time. You know, you dropped your lollipop, then you can infer you're not going to be able to eat that, you know, that lollipop anymore, whatever, you know. So it really, it's not that it's the skill of making inferences that gets better. It's really the context in which you apply that skill gets more sophisticated. And so that you have to make sure that you're paying attention to the overall context and also figuring out what is it, you know, like what's the knowledge? What is the information that I want kids to get? And how best can I get them to think about things and make connections between bits of information and all of those things that we want kids to do? Those are not free-floating skills. Those are dependent on the context.
Yeah.
Natalie, can I ask you one quick question about something you said that, you know, they can, it's easier to I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said it's easier to learn these strategies or skills with something they've already, they have a knowledge base about, or even easier to read a text of something they have a knowledge base about. But I'm wondering, I guess what I'm thinking of is like, I'm thinking of Presley actually, who just was like learning about the digestive system, right? But when she first started, she didn't know anything about the digestive system. But it doesn't mean that she can't learn about it from reading new text, right? And I don't want people to take your words in the wrong way, because I don't think what you're saying is like, kids cannot read anything unless they already have knowledge about it. So therefore only give them texts about things they already know. I don't think that's what you're saying. So I just wanted to put that out there so you can make sure.
You're absolutely right. I think that it's a question of degree. I mean, and what, you know, first of all, I would say that kids generally, they're going to be able to take in more sophisticated information and vocabulary through listening, really on average through middle school, than through their own reading. But once they've heard about concepts and heard words and talked about them, and then if they encounter those words and concepts in their reading, they'll go, oh, I know what that is. So it will help them with their own reading to have that knowledge that they've acquired through listening and discussion. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not that you can never read a text that you lack background knowledge on. It's really a question of reaching a critical mass, I would say, of information about the world and the vocabulary that goes with it. And so that, you know, if you're reading about the Ming Dynasty and you don't know anything about Chinese history per se, but you know what a dynasty is, and you may have heard the word Ming somewhere. I mean, it's that kind of, it can be even surface level knowledge, but it equips you then to acquire more knowledge through reading, because this all boils down really to working memory and the burden on working memory. And if you're reading a paragraph or a text that has above a certain, I mean, there has been some quantification of this, but above a certain percentage of unfamiliar words and concepts, you're going to be spending too much of your brain power just thinking, like, what's that word? And what's that word? And maybe I should go look this word up. And every time you do that, you lose the thread of the what you're reading. So at a certain point, I've acquired, I would say, a fair amount of knowledge or vocabulary about the world. But still, if you show me, a scholarly article on something like molecular biology, I'm not going to be able to make sense of it very easily. Right. But if you show me a newspaper article, pretty much any article that's in the newspaper, I probably will be able to make sense of it, because it's not assuming that I have specialized knowledge that I don't. But for a lot of people, you know, reading those articles, and certainly a lot of kids, is going to be a very, very tough thing to do, because they don't have the knowledge that's assumed. So it's just, you know, there's no bright line where you could say, oh, well, at this point, you will be able to read a text for which you don't have background knowledge on. It's really a balancing act. And I think all that we can do to equip kids, students, to be good general readers is to build as much knowledge for them as we can.
Yeah. And as they access those, you know, unknown texts and topics, you know, I'm thinking for the first time or for the second time, would you say I'm just asking this because I heard someone say it the other day. Would you say that strategies could be used to in service of learning the knowledge? So like the knowledge is the foundation, right? And the text is the foundation that's supplying the knowledge, but you're using the strategies to service yourself to grab that knowledge. Is that, would that be accurate?
Yeah. So, you know, I think do not skip over the basic comprehension questions. Like, you know, so I was once in, I think it was a third grade classroom. The teacher was reading with the students an article about early domestication of animals, you know, in ancient civilizations. And after she read just the first paragraph, maybe the first two paragraphs, her first question was, so what is the author's argument? And, you know, I mean, these were third graders. I think it would have been probably led to a richer discussion and maybe would have helped her figure out if they were following. I mean, first of all, I wouldn't stop after the first paragraph, but you could say, so why did people start domesticating animals? You know, was it just to eat them or, you know, let's talk about the content before we get to that analytical, you know. I think that many teachers have been maybe trained to believe that you want to skip over those lower order things like comprehension. You want to get straight to the higher order thinking, but there's no shortcut. You can't think analytically about something you haven't understood. So
those questions really could be questions that are servicing our access of content, really, right?
Yeah, and I think maybe in my view the most effective way to use those strategies, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it's through writing. Because, I mean, you know, like you mentioned cause and effect. Well, you know, the writing revolution has this because but so activity, where you give kids the same sentence stem, but have them finish it maybe three different ways. Andrew Jackson was a popular president because but so. But filling in just that so sentence, using that so conjunction, that is requiring kids to think about cause and effect in a very powerful way. They have to do it. It's not like, this is how you do it. It's you do it.
Yeah. And they're able to really write about that content, as we mentioned earlier, because they have the knowledge to do so.
And right. If you don't know about the presidency of Andrew Jackson, you can't finish those sentences.
Right. Yeah. That's great. Melissa, is there anything else that you think that we missed?
Well, like a million. We could just keep talking all day. just the one, I think, last thing I wanted to just go off of what you were saying about, you know, what I have in my head, I guess, is like, we talked about the eighth grade module in Wit and Wisdom that's All Quiet on the Western Front, because Lori and I did a lot of work on that for our first year together. And you know, it's a tough text. It's a sad text, really kind of depressing. But, you know, that is an example, I think, of, you know, it takes place during World War I. But a lot of it is much more about like the emotions that the soldiers were feeling and how that affected them in war. And yes, it took place during World War I, you know, that was the setting. And they like, so in Wit and Wisdom, they gave like just a little background on World War I, but it's not like they need weeks of World War I knowledge to understand it, because actually the knowledge is, you know, that they're trying to build there is more about the psychological effects of war on these young soldiers. And that's something that they can connect to, right? Like that's something that they can, they probably do have some prior knowledge about, like how does something traumatic affect a person? So I just think that there's something there too about like, you know, we went overboard a little bit again here in Baltimore City when we were revamping our high school curriculum with one of our modules about, the text was like Water for Chocolate. And I think we went a little overboard with giving background about the Mexican Revolution, when in fact, like that's just kind of the setting, but that's not really the content that or the what you want them to get from that text.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that's difficult for teachers at upper grade levels is, you know, they may be trying to, aside from the English class, the literary aspects of this. And right, you don't need to know all about the Mexican Revolution or whatever to understand like Water for Chocolate. But there, say you're teaching history or social studies and you're teaching about the Civil War or World War One, but you realize that your kids are missing a lot of information about what preceded those wars.
Yeah.
Well, you can't start with, I mean, I have talked to a teacher who was trying to teach about the Civil War, and she said, you kind of have to start with, well, there was this revolution, and this is who we won our independence from, and this is going to take you a long time to get the Civil War. And, you know, that's maybe, ideally, you wouldn't have to fill in those knowledge gaps, but if you do, the best way, I think, is to start with the Civil War, and use sort of writing and other checks for comprehension to target what is it that my kids need to understand this thing that we are working on? Because to build all the knowledge that they've missed is, it could be an endless proposition.
Yeah. Probably an impossible one, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. But that's what I also love about Wit and Wisdom is like the goal is to build that knowledge over time, right? And any content or knowledge building curriculum is, that's the goal, is that we do fill in those gaps along the way.
Yeah.
So Natalie, you know, at the end of our podcast, everyone gets to leave a piece of advice for our listeners. And so your piece of advice today could be grounded in a tip for quarantine, a tip for parents, just generally speaking. You could chat with teachers or leaders, like what to think about in the fall, whatever. You have the door is wide open for you right now. I mean, and you're more than welcome to choose any bucket you want. You can keep going for another 10 minutes if you want.
Well, gee, I forgot that you guys always ended this. I thought maybe since I've already been on the podcast, I had my chance to do that. Just off the top of my head, I mean, you mentioned parents. I think right now is a time when parents are getting a closer look at what goes on in their kids' classrooms, or you know, with their kids' education and their curriculum. And there may be parents out there that are wondering about some of those find the main idea assignments or whatever. And I think, you know, I think parents could be this real ally in the movement for a more knowledge-focused, content-rich curriculum. I think it makes intuitive sense to a lot of parents, and they may have assumed their kids were acquiring substantive knowledge and are kind of amazed to discover that's not the point, that's not what we're trying to do here. So yeah. I think, you know, teachers and parents who share this perspective could really use this as an opportunity to join forces and work for change together, because I think it's going to, you know, teachers need all the help they can get if they want to affect change. And I think parents could be hugely helpful.
That's
smart. You're always looking
wonderful. So thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you guys. This was great as always. I'm happy to come back even for a third time.
Yeah. It was about a year ago. So maybe we'll make a yearly standing invitation for Natalie Wexler.
All right. Thank
you. You were episode 10, right? And we posted episode 29 yesterday. And so that we're moving right. So we'll have to have you back for like 40. Like you can.
Yeah. Every 10 episodes. Great.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you guys.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.